This is Talk is Cheap on KEPW LP 97.3 FM Eugene, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Okay, so today I found something that I've been looking for a long time. There was an episode of the show One Step Beyond, which is very much like The Twilight Zone, only supposedly the stories are true. And One Step Beyond, they used to freak me out because, you know, they had these stories with witnesses that swore they were true, and they're really freaky. But this one episode, this one lost episode, was a live version of One Step Beyond, where John Newland, the host, the straight-laced host, in 1959, took mushrooms. Not just any mushrooms, yeah, those mushrooms, the psychedelic kind. John Newland from One Step Beyond takes mushrooms, coming up here on Talk is Cheap on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Support independent media and go to kepw.org. Thanks. Support independent media because you really need to right now. It may be too late. Okay, so just a little commentary that I gotta do because of the latest news that's going on. So, for one thing, you know, I noticed that conservative talk shows they talk about the elite, but their solutions are Reaganomics. So it is true that it is the elite and the neoliberals that are the problem, but the solution is not Reaganomic-style predatory capitalism. I just want to put that out there. So, because I sound a lot like Alex Jones, because what I'm saying is, what I noticed that they said that these economic sanctions, they said that they were going to hit the Russian oligarchs. But now I notice that the sanctions seem to affect mostly the middle class, and I have not heard them talk about taking the assets of the Russian oligarchs that is sitting in the banks, like Bank of England, and making them take their money out, either not necessarily sanction them, not necessarily seize their assets, but make them take their assets out of the Bank of England and put it in a less secure place. In other words, they'd have to put it in a third world country's bank, or whoever will take them, which is much more risky for them, and they may not make as much money on it, for one thing, but it will be a much more risky and not a secure place for them to keep their money. That's why they keep their money in the West, because it's a supposedly secure place to keep their money. So what I'm saying is then they would make sure the Russian oligarchs would pressure Putin if their assets were moved out of the Western banks. So that's what I'm having here. I just want to make that clear. And I don't think you're going to see that happen because that money is used as collateral in the Western banks. And ultimately they won't work because Russia and China are already in the process of moving off the dollar, the petrodollar. Okay, so this is from How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan on the resurgence of psychedelic therapy. This is about this guy that I've never heard of named, that they called Captain Tripp. He's kind of a opposite of Timothy Leary, kind of a conservative, wealthy aristocrat. Al Hubbard is surely the most improbable, intriguing, and elusive figure to grace the history of psychedelics, and that's saying a lot. There is much we don't know about him, and many key facts about his life are impossible to confirm, contradictory, or just plain fishy. To cite one small example, his FBI file puts his height at 5 feet 11, but in photographs and videos, Hubbard appears short and stocky, with a big round head topped with a crew cut. For reasons known only to himself, he often wore a paramilitary uniform and carried a Colt 45 revolver, giving the impression of a small-town sheriff. But based on his extensive correspondence with colleagues and a handful of accounts in the Canadian press and books about the period, as well as interviews with a handful of people who knew him well, it's possible to assemble a rough portrait of the man, even if it does leave some important areas blurry or blank. Hubbard was born poor in the hills of Kentucky in either 1901 or 1902. His FBI file gives both dates. He liked to tell people he was 12 before he owned a pair of shoes. He never got past the third grade, but the boy evidently had a flair for electronics. As a teenager, he invented something called the Hubbard Energy Transformer, a new type of battery powered by radioactivity that could not be explained by the technology of the day. This, according to the best account we have of his life, as well researched a well-researched 1991 High Times article by Todd Brendan Fahey. Hubbard sold a half interest in the patent for $75,000, though nothing ever came of the invention. And Popular Science magazine once included it in a survey of technological hoaxes. During Prohibition, Hubbard drove a taxi in Seattle, but that appears to have been a cover. In the trunk of his cab, he kept a sophisticated ship-to-shore communication systems he used to guide bootleggers seeking to evade the Coast Guard. Hubbard was eventually busted by the FBI and spent 18 months in prison on a smuggling charge. After his release from prison, the trail of Hubbard's life becomes even more difficult to follow, muddied by vague and contradictory accounts. In one of them, Hubbard became involved in an undercover operation to ship heavy armaments from San Diego to Canada, and from there on to Britain, in the years before the U.S. entered World War II, when the nation was still officially neutral. Scouts for the future OSS officer Alan Dulles, impressed by Hubbard's expertise in electronics, may or may not have recruited him for the mission. But when Congress began investigating the operation, Hubbard fled to Vancouver to avoid prosecution. There he became a Canadian citizen, founded a charter boat business, earning him the title of captain, and became the science director of a uranium mining company. According to one account, Hubbard had something to do with supplying uranium to the Manhattan Project. By the age of 50, the barefoot boy from Kentucky had become a millionaire, owner of a fleet of aircraft, a 100-foot yacht, a Rolls Royce, and a private island off Vancouver. At some point during the war, Hubbard apparently returned to the United States, and he joined the OSS shortly before the Wartime Intelligence Agency became the CIA. A few other curious facts about the pre-psychedelic Al Hubbard. He was an ardent Catholic with a pronounced mystical bent, and he was unusually flexible in his professional loyalties, working at various times as a rum and gun runner, as well as an agent for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Was he a double agent of some kind? Possibly. At one time or another, he also worked for the Canadian Special Services, the U.S. Department of Justice, and the Food and Drug Administration. His FBI file suggests he had links to the CIA during the 1950s, but the redactions are too heavy for it to be... But the redactions are too heavy for it to reveal much about his role, if any. We know the government kept close tabs on the psychedelic research community all through the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, funding university research on LSD and scientific conferences in some cases. And it wouldn't be surprising if, in exchange for information, the government would allow Hubbard to operate with as much freedom as he did. But this remains speculation. Al Hubbard's life
made a right-angled change, of course, in 1951. At the time, he was hugely successful, but unhappy, desperately searching for meaning in life. This, according to Willis Harmon, one of a group of Silicon Valley engineers to whom Hubbard would introduce LSD later in the decade. As Hubbard told the story to Harmon, and Harmon told it to Todd Brendan Fahey, he was hiking in Washington State when an angel appeared to him in a clearing. She told L that something tremendously important to the future of mankind would be coming soon, and that he could play a role in it if he wanted to. But he hadn't the faintest clue what he was supposed to be looking for. The clue arrived a year later in the form of an article in a scientific journal describing the behavior of rats given a newly discovered compound called LSD. Hubbard tracked down the researcher, obtained some LSD, and had a literally life-changing experience. He witnessed the beginning of life on Earth as well as his own conception. It was the deepest mystical thing I've ever seen, he told friends later. I saw myself as a tiny mite in a big swamp with a spark of intelligence. I saw my mother and father having intercourse. Clearly, this was what the angel had foretold. Something tremendously important to the future of mankind, Hubbard realized it was up to him to bring the new gospel of LSD and the chemical itself to as many people as he possibly could. He had been given what he called a special chosen role. Thus began Al Hubbard's career as the Johnny Appleseed of LSD. Through his extensive connections in both government and business, he persuaded Sandoz Laboratories to give him a mind-boggling quantity of LSD. A liter bottle of it in one account, 43 cases in another, 6,000 vials in a third. He reportedly told Albert Hoffman he planned to use it, quote, to liberate human consciousness. Depending on whom you believe, he kept his supply hidden in a safe deposit box in Zurich or buried somewhere in Death Valley, but a substantial part of it he carried with him in a leather satchel. Eventually, Hubbard became the exclusive distributor of Sandoz LSD in Canada and later somehow secured an investigational new drug permit from the FDA, allowing him to conduct clinical research on LSD in the United States. This, even though he had a third-grade education, a criminal record, and a single, arguably fraudulent scientific credential. His PhD had been purchased from a diploma mill. Seeing himself as a catalytic agent, Hubbard would introduce an estimated 6,000 people to LSD between 1951 and 1966, in an avowed effort to shift the course of human history. Curiously, the barefoot boy from Kentucky was something of a mandarin, choosing as his subjects leading figures in business, government, the arts, religion, and technology. He believed in working from the top down and disdained other psychedelic evangelists like Timothy Leary, who took a more democratic approach. Members of parliament, officials of the Roman Catholic Church, Hollywood actors, government officials, prominent writers and philosophers, university officials, computer engineers, and prominent businessmen were all introduced to LSD as part of Hubbard's mission to shift the course of history from the above. Not everyone Hubbard approached would play. J. Edgar Hoover, whom Hubbard claimed as a close friend, declined. Hubbard believed that if he could give the psychedelic experience to the major executives of the Fortune 500 companies, Abram Hoffer recalled, he would change the whole of society. One of the executives Hubbard turned on in the late 1950s, Myron Stolaroff, assistant to the president for long-term planning at Ampex, at the time a leading electronics firm in Silicon Valley, became convinced that Al Hubbard was the man to bring LSD to planet Earth.
Okay, so the other thing that's blowing my mind that I just wanted to tell you about is went and saw Terrence McKenna lecture back in the late 80s, I think it was. And one of the things McKenna said was that mushrooms can survive the rigors of space, mushroom spores. So he felt that mushrooms were nature and plants using us to take them throughout the universe, to spread them throughout the universe. So in Michael Pollan's book about psychedelic therapy, he's saying that they can't figure out how this evolved to where a plant would go straight to the serotonin of your brain, which cannabis does too. It has receptors. Those receptors you're all holding because there's receptors in your brain for cannabis. So you're all holding mushrooms too, because there's receptors in your brain. So they're not sure how this evolved. And what he's saying is, there's many instances in nature where a fungus will get into an animal or insect, cause that there's an ant that the fungus gets in this ant, and it makes the ant walk to high ground, and it gets in its brain and it makes it walk to high ground, and then spores explode out of the ant's head, and that's how this fungus disseminates itself. So we're wondering, do we work for the mushrooms, or are the mushrooms working us? Are the mushrooms changing our brains? Is it a symbiotic relationship, or is it a monster? I happen to think it's a symbiotic relationship, because you tend to be much more in tune with nature when you take mushrooms. Okay, so I have this from several sources, not just Michael Pollan, but there was a legal psychiatric therapy in the late 50s that Stars were taking and Cary Grant was taking, that became illegal in the 60s when people started demonstrating against war. They blamed psilocybin and mushrooms and mind-expanding drugs for people being against war. So they had to shut that down. But yeah, there was a therapy, and it was very successful, although it was difficult to test. It seemed to be successful in a lot of psychiatric care to use either one session of high-dose psychedelics, or Cary Grant was taking 10 micrograms all the time for long periods of time. So all that stopped in the 60s, and now good news, and that's partly why I'm doing this show, is because we need some good news right now. Good news, we might see some psychedelic therapy coming up here in the future. Okay, so a little history. Albert Hofmann synthesized LSD from psilocybin back in 1943, and then they discovered a cult that used mushrooms in Mexico in 1955, and that cult was very skittish about telling people anything about it because of the Spanish Inquisition was killing anybody that, mushrooms, you don't want to be... The Spanish didn't want anybody, religious people didn't want anybody talking to God without the church, or seeing God without the church. So when these Mexican brujos said they could see God, the Spanish had to shut that down right away. So that's why they're so skittish about talking to Westerners or strangers about the sacred mushroom. So apparently, John Newland, the host of One Step Beyond, and Rod Serling, of course, the host of The Twilight Zone, apparently they knew each other. Do you suppose they took mushrooms and sat across from each other with a piece of incense? You know, Joe Biden and Putin, that's what they need to do, is take some mushrooms together and sit across from each other with some incense. And neoliberals need to definitely take some LSD. And why hasn't the CIA put LSD in the water supply like they promised long ago? They've been holding out on us.
Mexico, thousands of miles from our Hollywood sound stages in a place called Mitla, on the very edge of civilization. There are no actors, there's no script. For this psychic report can only be recorded at the moment it happens. Here in the plaza of the Kings of Zapotec, here in the antiquity of Mexico, we begin a search whose ending at this very moment of filming, we do not know. We are searching for something far older than these ruins, which, if found, could hurtle ordinary man infinitely beyond his five senses. And now the first step beyond. The first step is a faltering one. We wait day after day for perfect flying weather. For the only way to reach our goal, the inaccessible village of Juquila, is by light plane over trackless mountains. Has he come back yet?
No.
Well, keep your fingers crossed. This lovely hacienda at the foot of the Dombach Mountains has been here a little longer than we have, but not much. From here, weather permitting, our chartered plane will fly us to a remote mountain village to look for, of all things, a mushroom. But a very strange mushroom indeed, with powers beyond belief. And here are the mushroom hunters, as improbable a group as you will find anywhere. For instance, this is Dr. Barbara Brown, brilliant neuropharmacologist of the University of California at Los Angeles. With her is David Gray, one of the last kahunas of Hawaii, a spiritual leader whose line goes back 900 years and whose quest for knowledge beyond the world of materialism has led him everywhere in the world. And now here, and here, with friend, is Jeffrey Smith, a distinguished professor of philosophy and humanities at Stanford University. And now, and mighty important, is our translator, William Upson, a missionary who has lived among the people of our remote village for the last 9 years, and the only man in the world who speaks their language.
The pilot says he'll be ready soon, John.
And last, our forever optimistic, Dr. Andre Puharish, who wrote the astounding book, The Sacred Mushroom. Dr. Puharish's book brought us here in the first place, and in it, he explains how the mushroom seems to have an incredible effect on the power of extrasensory perception.
Incredible is the word. We're here for some very specific purposes. We want to know why these people here in Mexico have kept this right so secret for so many centuries. But I would say that our prime mission is to explore and examine the biochemicals present in these new mushrooms and find out if they can be of any benefit in this problem of mental disease.
What Dr. Puharish hasn't told you, it is not all as simple as it sounds. The last time he was here looking for the mushroom, a man was shot.
And shot at.
And another man was driven out of his mind.
For a while.
El piloto dice que ya.
In English, dice que ya means the pilot said, now. The shadows of our two small planes fall on rainforests which hide villages where the 20th century does not exist. And that's the landing strip, chopped by hand out of a mountainside. Missionaries can bring the word of God to this lost world. As we approach, the pilot warns us to grab hold of something and hang on. A sudden gust of wind could smash us against the mountain or plunge us into the abyss below. At last, we are in the village of Juquila, slogging through mud. Each of us with an odd sense that all the clocks have stopped ticking. We've brought television cameras to people who've never even heard of radio, who've never seen a telephone, an electric light, who've never heard of aspirin, let alone penicillin. But perhaps the sacred mushroom has given them a psychic insight far beyond our deepest explorations. He breaks up to go about its various investigations. Dr. Brown and a missionary nurse named Dean Duggan go looking for the mushroom. guarded by armed soldiers, because in the past months, shots have been fired, machetes have been flashed, and mushroom hunters who came before us have been murdered. Dr. Puharish and missionary Upson begin searching the town for a brujo, a priest of the mushroom cult. But everywhere they go, an iron curtain of silence comes clanging down. Amid much shaking of the head and wagging of the finger, everyone emphatically denies the existence of a mushroom cult. And it is made very clear that if this is why we have come to Hokila, we are not welcome. Our search seems hopeless until Dr. Puharish gets an idea that might help us push open an ancient door. Bill Upson is sent through the village announcing that a free medical clinic is open to one and all. Within minutes, the first patient appears. A little Chitino Indian with a lot of aches and a lot of pains. And then they come in droves. All of them humble. All of them hopeful. All of them grateful. Finally, the mother of a child whom Dr. Puharish has treated timidly suggests that she might help. Kindness and a bottle of vitamins have worked a magic of their own. Sometime tonight, we will have a visitor. Thanks to the help of the sick child's mother, secret arrangements are made, and we are guided to this hidden place to wait. But it is almost midnight before the brujo appears. He has practiced the secret and all but forbidden rites of the sacred mushroom for decades. Rites passed on from father to son for perhaps 4,000 years. But of course, he has never performed before such an audience or a camera. Our scientists have prepared test questions to evaluate the brujo's extrasensory perception. But he insists on one condition. To achieve spiritual union, they also must eat the mushroom. However, in the interest of detached scientific observation, he agrees that Dr. Brown does not have to take the mushroom. The rites begin. A strangely aromatic root is burned. Inhaled. The brujo murmurs incantations in Chitina, a language unknown anywhere else. The following is one moment when he is startlingly correct. Suddenly he turns to Dr. Brown, whom of course he has never seen or heard of before.
Very good.
You're still sick. You're sick in the chest. Your heart. Your heart is sick.
Can you ask for specific?
No, let's try to get a
picture. You said both of you.
Without a moment's hesitation, he accurately diagnosed a personal illness that only Dr. Brown knows about. Our next experience with a brujo and the sacred mushroom comes quickly and unexpectedly. And this time it has nothing to do with scientific investigation. Since it is now common knowledge that we have already witnessed the rite, we are allowed to come along to see a second priest at work, a man named Macedonia, who agreed to take the mushroom and listen to the villagers' problem.
He said his burro was stolen and he wants to know where to find it.
In this village of Hukila, the theft of a burro, a man's most important possession, his donkey, is second only to murder.
He said three men are involved.
Macedonia hardly paused a moment before he named the thieves.
Gustavo said he was going to take the three of them to jail tomorrow. But Don Macedonio warned him not to go near the house of Juan and Pedro because they would kill him, but to look for it in the house of Jose.
We go with the villager through a valley, across fields, past other villages to the exact spot where Macedonio said the burro would be. And here indeed it is, its identifying brand clearly marked on the burro's flank. Now perhaps we can understand, more or less, why for 4,000 years, and from one civilization to the next, the sacred mushroom has endured. We have been given a practical demonstration of how it works in the daily lives of this primitive people. 3 weeks have passed. and we're a long way from our remote mountain village of Juquila in Mexico. We're also a long way from the secret rites of the sacred mushroom cult. But our search for the truth about the mushroom, that is, the truth as we understand it, is far from over. These men are our technical crew who have come with me from Los Angeles to help us continue our search. We've come to the home and laboratory of Dr. Andre Puharish in Northern California. For me, personally, this next step beyond may be a rather large one. This is part of the laboratory and study of Dr. Puharish. Here among his solid and sound books of orthodox medicine, there are also other books. They are written in French and Spanish. In English, here's one that says, Mushrooms, Russia, and History. They're written in Syrian, Japanese, all the languages of the world. And they're all concerned with one thing, the same thing, the riddle of the sacred mushroom. Now, when we were in Mexico, the brujo who discovered the stolen burro might have been coincidence. And the other brujo who told Dr. Barbara Brown about her past illness might have made a wild guess. But today, we should be able to prove the case for or against the mushroom, the sacred mushroom, with quite a lot more accuracy.
What's that now, John?
Those the mushrooms you brought back from Mexico?
Yes.
Andre, how many people have you tested since you've been back?
You'll be number 26.
What about the results?
Encouraging. The average of the group as a whole, and the series is quite small, you understand, shows evidence for extrasensory perception after taking the mushrooms.
Well, I'm ready. Better than I'm as ready as I'm ever going to be.
Well, not quite yet. We have to do some control tests first to see if you have any ESP before you take the mushroom.
Oh, I see.
And these will be done with cards, pictures, and books.
I see.
Now, you just sit still there. Take your left hand and bring it in here on this first block. There's a row of 10 blocks by you. You bring your right hand over and you scan this far row and you remain sensitive to any impressions. And when you think you're over the card that matches the one your left hand is on, you pick it up and move it opposite that card.
I see.
And you've got nothing on the pictures. This is a chance score and shows
that despite 3 years with our show, I have what they would call practically no extrasensory perception at all.
That's what the test
shows. Well, what do we do now?
Now to eat the mushroom.
All right, I'm ready. Maybe that's an improvement. Which ones are we going to eat? You have so many here, Andre. Which one is
mine? These are for you. These are... Chew them well when you ingest. Not bad, are they?
Tastes just like mushrooms.
And one more for you.
Oh, dry. All right. What now?
Now we'll lie you down on the bed. produce some physical testing before the effects of the mushroom take hold.
Like what? Like what effects?
You'll find out. Well, it's been about 20 minutes since you had the mushroom, John. How do you feel?
Fine. I feel strong, sort of. You know, it's kind of hard to... strong, a sense of... kind of sense of well-being, is that...
Yes, some people feel that way. Let's try something. Let's try something. I want you to stand right up here in front of this light.
Yeah.
Yes, close your eyes and tell me what you see. Lower your head a little bit. A little more. Now.
Oh, I see it. Now I see it. I see so many things I can't tell you. Can't you slow it?
Slow it?
Now I see, like... But I see so many colors that are... Go...
Are they pretty?
In geometric signs, that now it's like great things. They're magnificent, what they are. They're magnificent. I have never been so aware of color. Of color. It makes me quite dizzy. I feel like I would like to dive into the middle of it.
Well, we'll try the card test again.
Now.
All right, same way. Start with your left hand and try to find the one in this row. John. Want to try another one?
Please. It has a great deal of... It has something... A power of... noise. I don't know how to translate that into a picture. It seems to have that noise and speed.
Pretty good. Would you like to take a look and see what it's like? Amazing, isn't it?
Holy mackerel, that really is. Andre, before you tell me anything about the score, let me tell you something. That I did feel something sort of profound. No, profound. When touching the pictures, touching the cards, I felt something. I don't know how I did, but the sensation.
Well, John, I can tell you it wasn't a delusion on your part because your card scores were 12 hits out of 50, which are significant for ESP. You got 3 out of 16 of the page numbers on the book. And, of course, most intriguing of all was your work with the pictures. You got 6 adequate descriptions out of 8 pictures.
It's a marvelous sensation.
You know, Andre,
I think I understand a little why for so many centuries they have called this mushroom sacred. Now our mushroom hunters are reassembled here in our studio. Dr. Brown, was our search worth it?
Yes, I think so. The chemicals in the mushrooms, I think, will offer us another tool by which we can explore the mechanisms and the capabilities of the mind of man, and that's both sensory and extrasensory.
What about you, Professor Smith?
Well, John, the more I experience of life in its ordinary and extraordinary aspects, the more I feel like a wide-eyed child reaching for knowledge and life. As for the mushroom, it took me out into worlds I didn't believe existed, far beyond ordinary perception. And yet, even today, they're as real and as important to my everyday life as anything I've experienced.
Dr. Puharish?
During our stay in Hokila, I witnessed quite a number of cases of extrasensory perception by the Brujos, some of which we could not film, as you know, John. These, in addition to the ones we did film, and the work which we have done since our return, convinces me that the mushroom contains a chemical which is most promising for the further investigation of extrasensory perception.
When this program began, the question was, were the claims for the mushroom true or false? Well, for those of us who made the journey, the answer is true.
Get you on your feet. some information first. But just the basic facts. Can you show me where it hurts? I can't hear what you're saying.
also brought to you by Billy Bob Clinton's Missiles R Us.
Hi, I'm Billy Bob Clinton, the largest dealer of missiles in the world. I've sold more missiles than anybody. I'll eat a bug to sell you a missile. I got a herd of missiles. I'm practically giving them away. They're stacked up here like cordwood. No cash. We have instant credit. We'll take just about any collateral. We'll take oil, minerals, cheap labor, just about anything. This week's special F-15 fighters, only 5 left, so get here fast. Take the Pennsylvania Avenue past Silo 16 till you come to the crater in the road. Turn right and you're at Billy Bob Clinton's Missiles R Us. Come near closing time wearing a thong and I'll show you a wrinkled missile.
There's a scourge threatening the airwaves right now. I'm talking about that earworm wrangler and rhyme criminal, Justin Bieber. I don't care if he gets his coke from Columbia, his product from Pennsylvania. He should be arrested just for rhyming holy with hold me. His music is vapid. His lyrics are trite. Now don't kill Justin Bieber. Cutting his hair will only slow him down. If you want to stop Justin Bieber and others like him, go to kepw.org and become a sustaining member. Or just send a couple of dollars. We're all volunteers, so you get more bang for your buck. Go to kepw.org and stop inane music today.